Hey folks, and welcome to Dungeon Casters, the Dungeon Master Advice Show for Rookie DMs by Rookie DMs.
I'm Ben.
And I'm Scott.
And we're here to help you make your new campaign.
In a dirty college dorm room bathtub.
Dude, did you make this podcast? I like it. I'm happy with it. So yeah, so this week, we're going to be talking about homebrew materials in your campaign, which is kind of a weird topic, because I feel like it is the most exciting part and the most frustrating part of DMing, because it's so infinite, but you, and a lot of it looks really great on paper, a lot of it's really exciting and stuff, maybe you made stuff you found online, whatever, but it can be kind of tricky to make it work right. It can be kind of hard to know what you're looking at. It's sometimes like it's like putting together a car from six different cars, and you're never really sure if it's going to run, if it's going to pull to the left. You don't really know, so it could be
You're making a Mad Max mobile out of your
car. Yeah, man. Absolutely. Now,
I do want to start this conversation off with talking about how every campaign Ben and I have run, with very few exclusions, is homebrew, because we do not use Wizards of the Coast's setting.
That's fair.
Greyhawk, we do not use the Sword Coast, we do not use Chut, we don't use any of their settings, we always make our own. And that is personal preference kind of thing, for me, at least.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I guess there's, like, kind of tiers of homebrew that you
there
put
certainly
in.
Is.
Because I would say that, largely, I don't consider my game homebrew, insofar as I use the monsters that are in the book most of the time. The classes that people run are by and large the ones in the book. There's been some Unearthed Arcana classes that my players have run, but those seem to actually be few and far between.
The Unearthed Arcana eventually becomes standard.
Yeah, like in most of the time anyway. Not always in the same form, but yeah.
All of them are dropped in Xanthar's Guide now.
Yeah, just about.
All those Unearthed Arcanas, I suppose, are like their, whatchamacallit, when you have a focus group. Like, it's their focus grouping, where they see what people think about those and see the feedback and then edit them and put them in the final printing of the book.
Yeah, so I guess in that regard, it's not really homebrew material at all. That's still very canonical. So, I would agree that our games are 9 times out of 10, at least, I don't know, 20 or 30% homebrew, just by the virtue of being in a place that we've created with a sort of, I was going to say a sort of history that we've created, but you tend to make much more of a backstory than I do. So that's on a gradient too, but
here's the thing is, like, even if you don't put 100% of your worlds down on paper, they're all up in your noodle, and like, you do as much prep as I do in your noodle. I just write more of it down on paper
because
I have more free time.
Roughly true. Yeah.
But like, I think about that. I don't even know if it was a one-shot or if it was going to be something bigger that we ran not too long ago. You were DMing. Actually, the last time you DM'd for me, when we were working at the Arcane Supply Superstore.
Oh, yeah.
And it was essentially, like, the premise was, like, we worked at Walmart, and we were, like, backroom stock guys.
Yeah.
But the Walmart was from, like, all those weird-ass, like, wizard components for all the spells. So it's all these, like, really bizarre items, and there was this elevator, like, a la Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, where it was, like,
exactly what that's from.
Yeah, and it was, like, a million floors, and each floor was, like, I was like, oh, we need griffin feathers for this order. It's like, we go to floor 17, and there are just, like, griffins sitting there, so we have to figure out how to get the feathers. And, like, that setting is nowhere near anything Wizards have put out. Like, yes, it's grounded in their world in the sense of the like, things that exist, the items and the objects, but, like, everything else was homebrew.
Yeah,
a lot of people don't acknowledge that.
No, that's true. I mean, you're absolutely right. I hadn't really thought of it in those terms, but you're correct. You know, I think probably the only true way to not play homebrew would be to get one of the guidebooks, one of the pre-made adventure books that Wizards publishes, and you don't change a thing. everything is verbatim. So in that regard, congratulations, you've probably already been homebrewing for the entirety of your DM career. So you only have to do a little more or a little less. I want a side note. I wasn't crazy about my execution as DM in that game, but I am still very much convinced that, like, Magic Walmart is a great place for adventures because it's just, like, an elevator full of pocket dimensions.
I want to revisit it. I want to revisit it so bad.
Yeah, I had a couple of things planned out, and I was like, this is going okay. By the time we got to, I don't know, I think it was a rock. You needed, like, rock feathers. And I put y'all in wingsuits, and it was just like, this is awesome. I love this. Everyone's having a great time. Everybody, heads up, wingsuits in D&D, very cool. Changes the game because everybody can fly. You get three-dimensional combat, or combat with a Z-axis, I should say.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you just get to use a bunch of cool flying enemies you don't really get to deal with very often on, you know, different terms. Consider it. It's very fun.
Yeah, but, it is. It was great.
Well, thank you. But yeah, so I'll say, I don't know, even though I agree with you that we've used homebrew, whether or not we've realized it over the years, I will say that probably you've used more homebrew components than I have. I'm getting out of this, as probably most, if not all, DMs do after they've played for so much time. But more and more I'm realizing that the rules set down by Wizards are like a great basis for play, but they have a lot of spaces that, I don't know, there's a lot of cracks to fall through, there's a lot of things that don't really make as much sense as they might seem to at first, and I think actually a lot of that's by design. You know, there's been a lot of complaint, criticism, conversation regarding, like, the CR system, like the challenge rating system, for example. Yeah. Kind of like, it puts out, everyone said, like, I don't really know how to figure this out, and then there was a lot of hoopla because Wizards kind of acknowledged that they themselves don't use it when they play, and then it was just kind of like, well, what the hell are we supposed to do? But I think the idea is that it gave you a sort of rough estimate to start with, and you were expected to kind of trial and error decide for yourself and for your players what was maybe the most reasonable way to handle monsters of certain kinds based on what they're playing, how they play, what sort of adventure you want to have. So I think, though, that you have just been more willing than I have to include outside materials, more imaginative, more sort of self-generated materials, you know, reskins that are more than just reskins that have stat changes, reskins that have ability changes, reskins that combine two different things, settings that have traits and characteristics and effects that are not necessarily in the books, things you find online. I know that there's been times where that's been difficult or hasn't gone exactly how you hope, but I think that you have been much more willing than I to do it, because I, probably like a lot of DMs, I was afraid that introducing too much material that Wizards hadn't, like, accounted for would cause chaos, or somebody would just be, like, stupid powerful and uncontrollable. I really wouldn't have a good reference for what to do with them, so on and so forth. But you haven't been quite as hesitant about that stuff, it's always seemed to me.
Well, and here's why, right? So first off, like, I don't care about the rules. Fuck the rules.
All right, first, anarchy. First, it's just fucking anarchy rules.
Second off, I believe we've talked about it last season. I don't know how in-depth, but there was a time right when I first started. Like, this was maybe my third campaign I had ever DM'd, where I decided that I was going to reskin all of Dungeons & Dragons 3.5th edition into steampunk.
Yeah.
And, like, not even, like, oh, everyone pick what character you want to be and I'll just reskin your characters. I was like, no, I'm going to rebuild each class, everything. And not only was I going to rebuild everything to fit steampunk aesthetics, but I was eliminating magic.
Yeah.
So I eliminated magic from the game, and I, like, switched it all out with you know, technology, clockwork, like, essentially spells became, like, flamethrower situations like that, and, like, and I just, like, swapped and flopped and just, like, it fell to shit. It was a goddamn train wreck, and I ran it for a while. I ran, like, 3 or 4 separate campaigns in that steampunk mod, like, with different groups of people, and it was a train wreck the whole time forever, every single time. And, like, this is the thing. No one gave a shit.
No.
Like, the rules were trash. The balancing was so fucking off. All of the enemies in the plot I was running were constructs, and in 3.5, constructs were immune to critical damage. I mean,
they were
so, like, all of the enemies everyone was fighting were immune to critical hits. So, like, this was just, like, constantly just, like, shitting on these people over and over again. And they were all still stoked on it because it was just, like, yeah, this stuff is pretty cool looking, right? Yeah. Like, I'm playing D&D, but my guy's got guns. How weird is that? Yeah. And, like, yeah, that was enough for them.
I remember when we played that, and I had a character who was, like, the class was, like, I think it was, like, some version of a druid, maybe, or a ranger. Whichever in 3.5 gave you a pet. It may have been both at that time. Either way, it was a sort of, like, necromancer was the sort of, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like,
you were an engineer.
I was an engineer, essentially, like, and I had this robot dog who I love very much. And I took this whole class, like, I want this robot dog. And I was like, damn the consequences of me basically wearing, like, a leather apron into combat. The first combat, like, round one of the enemies, I got domed with a rifle, and that was it. My character was, like, minus 20 right off the bat. I made it, like, 30 seconds into this game. And so there were some issues. There were some issues. We acknowledge that. And I wonder, I imagine that that's a lot of the fear that sort of goes in when you start to homebrew. You're like, have I made this impossible or, like, too easy? You know what I mean? That's kind of where I sit. I'm getting better at it. You know, I'm becoming more lenient and just being like, well, what's the worst that could really happen? If it's a mess, I'm just going to be like, all right, backtrack 10 seconds. We're not doing that.
Hey,
yeah, it's retcon season. Everybody's getting one. But I think that for a lot of new DMs, and probably for experienced DMs too, there's this hesitation about adding materials that don't have, let's say, quality assurance in the same way, you know? I mean, you can't necessarily say, like, Wizards has it all perfected, because they certainly don't. But there is this kind of, like, maker's guarantee that is implied when you get the books. Like, this works, and it's all even. And probably we should disillusion anybody to that fact right now. It's not. It isn't. The books, there's janky stuff in them all over, and just because it's published doesn't mean it's perfect. It just goes through possibly more rigorous testing on the whole than your average online class would.
Just kidding, Wizards. We love all of your products.
Look, you can love things and criticize them, and we love their game, and we like their books, and their art is beautiful. And we've had much fun with the product they produce, but it's got some wobbly bits, and, you know, the point is just that you look at the books and they look very concise, very put together, very structured. Everything has got a nice line. It's mathed out for you. It looks like it's gone through the ringer, and it has, but there's parts of it that don't function as well as others, and things, you know, all things aren't equal. And so just know that even if you are following the rules, you still will run into these issues of kind of, this doesn't quite, these things aren't the same, this doesn't work quite the way I thought it would, this progression's a little too slow, this progression's a little too fast. And so when you're going into homebrew materials, whether it's stuff that you're inventing completely from scratch, or stuff that you're finding online, know that it's still kind of relatively in the same ball field in terms of that quality assurance factor. Certainly some stuff is a mess, but I'm just saying.
I mean, and here's the thing with that is, all right, we already talked about, you know, what I feel like I might have shocked you a little bit when I said that you homebrew and that all your settings that you make from scratch are technically
homebrew.
Yeah,
I mean, I wasn't expecting it, Scott. You kind of screwed me up for the day. I'm going to have to think. I'm gonna dream about this one. I got to sit on it.
That's my role here. But also, the second most common, or even maybe tied for first most common homebrew that people do that they don't realize is homebrew, is house rules. So the clearest example of it is critical hits. Everyone has a different critical hit rule depending on what table you're playing at. I have some people where it's double all the damage. I have some people where it's double just the dice. I have some people where it's roll two dice. So it depends on which house or which, you know, DM is running the game, which rule you're using. So house rules are like the exact solution to that, you know, quality assurance loophole or gaps, you know, in the built game mechanics from Wizards is like, you go home and you're playing and you're like, you know what, this rule's kind of janky, it doesn't make sense to me, I don't like how it functions, I don't want to play with this rule anymore. You can change it. It's not like a video game where it's like locked in place. It's you can just change it and you're good to go. And then you have your own new homebrew rule.
I mean, that's a great point. And like we kind of mentioned earlier, there are levels of homebrew that are more consequential than others, and things like that. You know, how do you run criticals? That I mean, that certainly has a large consequence. You know, certainly there's a large consequence attached to that. You know, if you're like all criticals are one hit kills, well, you might be running a very short game. You know, but making those small determinations between roll two dice, you get advantage on your damage, you just do double damage, you do triple damage, I consider it a sneak attack, you know, in terms of damage, like whatever you want to do. Those are on the lower end of consequence because you are probably only talking about, you know, killing one figure. You are not bound as the DM to be like, oh, well, they died, now they just die. I mean, if it's too much, you determine it's too much, you just say, it took you down to zero, it took them down to zero, you know, wasn't expecting it to do quite as much as it did. We're going to wave our magic fingers and we'll sort of fix it in post. And that's the nice thing, too, about something as small as that. That's just a one-off type of thing. If it doesn't work, you just say, like, all right, everybody, underestimated that. Next time, that's not how this is going to go. You know, it's very small change. I mean, you can do that with, you know, something like area of effect. For spells can be kind of like that. If you say like, well, I mean, there's no reason this would stop at this range, or there's no reason you couldn't turn it into a circle as opposed to a square, give it a shot. If it turns out to be a real mess, just don't do it again. You know, just say like, you know, your person tried it and took a lot out of them, or you didn't feel like you could control it. And if you want to add a narrative to it, if you're gonna do that, say like, that was a fluke. You know, that was just a fluke that you pulled. Probably couldn't do it again if you tried. Or just tell your player, like, hey, thought this would be fine. Turns out this is a mess. Let's not do that. I can't keep that under reasonable control. I don't think, you know, and that happens. And sometimes they'll be pissed because they thought it was real sweet and everything. But these are the, you know, you have to kind of feel out a lot of stuff with homebrew because your players want to be as cool and as powerful as they can possibly get, and homebrew can kind of let them. So it's your job to make a determination about kind of where that line is, and remember that changes like that, like being able to shape spells into different things easily, or criticals and how they're determined, those are going to double. Theoretically, you can make this decision too. They can double for enemies. And that may or may not help even the playing field. Sometimes giving an enemy one thing that a player has turns out to be like way stronger than it should be, or vice versa. Sometimes it just means that generally things are higher or lower stakes.
Well, and that's the thing, is like a good way to combat worrying about like, oh, if this is a steady ability, and it's super broken, and all of a sudden, like, all my casters can shape their spells like an octopus can fit through these tiny crevasses,
hell yeah.
Right? And then, like, every spell hits every enemy every time they do it. That's super broken. And if the enemies do it, they're going to party wipe every time. So, instead of making it just, like, the rule, making it a feat is a great way to kind of curb that. They can pick that ability at level 4 or level 8 or whatever levels you get feats, but then you don't get a stat bump. So you have to choose, do you want the stat bump or do you want this dope-ass ability? And finagling small bits, and I mean, even in the DM's guide, the last like chunk of it is how to make your own monsters, how to make your own rules, how to make your own feats, how to make your own races, how to make your own class, like how to make your own everything. So they encourage for this kind of stuff to happen so that you can, you know, the game can build and grow. The game is a living entity, and it needs, you know, this kind of constant input from the players and the GMs and everyone who's, you know, touching the game to make it better and to grow it. So
that's absolutely true. I mean, I have to admit, I mean, I always looked at that make your own section with a little bit of fear because it seems really intimidating, right? Like, there's a lot that goes into it, and then you have to make some sort of determination on what you've made is even an approachable contest for your players, which, you know, just given some times where I thought things were fine and they weren't, or vice versa, it's hard to know, and it can be intimidating to just create something from nothing and go, well, I hope it's fine, but you don't know.
Well, and that's, you know, one of my favorite sections of the DM's guide. And their big piece of advice is take something that exists and tweak it.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
So, like, in regards to the intimidation of homebrewing, the first thing I would say is, you know, you build it in steps. We talked about designing your own setting. There's homebrewing. Making a couple of your own rules just for the way that your friends and you play. There's another bit of homebrewing. I recently started a campaign where I designed a bunch of unique magic items for the campaign setting. That is a homebrew that everyone does all the time. And you go online and search, you can find billions of cool, dope, magical homebrew items. And, I mean, honestly, the way to see if they're broken or not is to test them and take them away from the players if they're too broken.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, something that has limited use, you know, you only get 3 uses out of it, I mean, is a terrific way to curtail anything that is at first glance just too strong. It's like, oh, it conjures, you know, 10d6 lightning damage every time you open it. It's like, that's pretty excessive until much higher levels. But if you say that you're only getting 2, yeah, they'll kill 2 people almost without fail, but they're only getting 2. You know, that's pretty easy to keep under control. And so those kinds of small limitations are tremendously helpful. Also, they'll come to appreciate that stuff more because they're like, ooh, only get 2 out of this. I'm going to save it for something really dramatic and sweet. You know, they're not going to just waste it on everybody they find.
Or they're going to be like me and they're just going to waste it on the first shrub they come across.
They could just waste it on the first shrub they come across.
Which, I mean, either way, problem solved. It's a non-issue regardless. And I think the next step after magic items would be backgrounds or races. You tweak something that already exists. For the campaign I'm running right now, I made a couple backgrounds too. I didn't have the characters choose those backgrounds. They were just options. So, like, I had one, there's a, like, tribe of roaming gypsies in the setting. So a background could be gypsy. And it's essentially just rustic hospitality, but instead of all poor people, it's all gypsies that come across. And their skills are like deception and sleight of hand that comes with the rustic hospitality for gypsies kind of thing. And so it's like real simple tweaks. They tell you how to sub it in and out, and it's just like each background gets like a language and a skill proficiency, or 2 languages, or 2 skill proficiencies, and then two other things, and then, like, a third thing, and then the ability, and then bada bing, bada boom, you've made your background. So, you could do this stuff
pretty
easily.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely the mistake I made early on, was not fully recognizing and accepting that the structures for anything you could want are already in the books. That if you say, like, oh, I want a creature that is physically strong and good at charisma casting. It's like, there's probably in one of the books, like, a physically strong charisma casting monster, of at least of some variety. You can easily sort of find something that falls in that category, and then change the paint, change the abilities, you know. And if it says, like, it's got, oh, I don't know, 3 level 1 spells and 2 level 2 spells and 2 level 3 spells, just take those spells out, put the same amount of spells in the same amounts back in whatever you choose. And then for the same thing, like spell-like abilities, it says, like, oh, it can turn invisible. It's like, well, if you want to give it invisibility, give it invisibility. Or give it a similar sort of, give it really high stealth or something. Or just give it a movement ability that's roughly equivalent. You know, the very, you know, incredible jumping. You know, jumps really, really high. But use those sort of mannequins. You know, you don't have to build the mannequin. You just have to put the clothes on it. And I think that was something I forgot a lot about. And like you said, the backgrounds, it's the same thing. I mean, how many jobs are there in the whole world? How many places do people start? I mean, it's like practically infinite. And the handbook has, what, like 15 of them, something like that, you know? And I mean, that doesn't really encompass the full breadth of human experience and human occupation and stuff like that. No. And so you take one that's like roughly equivalent and you start shifting things around. You say, oh, this gets a couple languages, I'll give it a couple languages. It gets like a couple of skills, I'll give it similar skills. You know, you can use those scaffolds as opposed to just having to build up from the ground.
Well, and that's the thing is, I mean, there's like, I think somewhere around the 45 range with all the extended ones that have come out with all the supplements. Yeah, and some of them are like really strange and like you wouldn't think about it. Like anthropologist is not something that existed in high fantasy times. Or that's like not a lot of adventurers think of their origins as being an anthropologist. But it does make sense, and the skills are, you know, applicable. And some of them are super campaign-specific. Like, there's, like, guild, or there's, I forget what they are, but, like, they're very specific to one of the pre-made campaigns, where it's like, oh, you were a prisoner in this specific prison, in this specific city, and you were released with this exact kind of situation. And so it's like, okay, it could have just been my background was a prisoner, but instead my background is X, Y, and Z prisoner, and it's like really specific. So you can just reskin that to just be like any prisoner.
Absolutely.
And that's actually how I eventually came to the solution of my, you know, steampunk catastrophe. When, especially, you know, moving over to 5e and everything, I was just like, alright, so instead of making the mistake to try to eliminate magic, which was a dumb idea, I just made a decision to reskin everything, in the sense that, like, the rogue still has all of the same abilities, but the names of everything is different. The, like, spells are still the same, they're just the way in which they're cast is different. So, also, like, bows have become guns. All melee weapons have been watered down to the size of, like, Victorian-era gang weapons, so to speak. So, like, instead of a spear, it's, like, a stick, like a table leg. Or instead of, like, all these different kinds of swords and daggers and stuff, it's just like, alright, so it's different kind of knives. Like, instead of an axe, like, instead of carrying around, like, a battle axe, you have, like, a meat cleaver. So, it's roughly the same kind of weapon. It's still going to be a big, flat, slashing blade, but it's the kind of thing you could tuck in your coat pocket because, like, you live in a civilized city where you can't carry around weapons anymore or some such. And the other instance of reskinning that I have that I've never actually enacted, but I think is, like, almost solely psychologically on the idea of the player, is I think I might have talked about this in an episode. I've wanted to make Corvo from Dishonored my whole life as a D&D character. I've always wanted to make, but it's really hard because of the one ability of, like, at will teleportation all the time forever. There's nothing that gives you that with that amount of reliability.
Very high up on that spell list. You'll get it like a couple times a day.
Exactly.
Top tier. Yeah.
Misty Step, Dimension Door, you get them a couple times a day and that's it. So, I was thinking about it, and you look at the rogue's cunning action, right? You can dash, disengage, or hide as a bonus action. So, that aesthetically is just like, oh, he's really slick and ducky and whatever, or aesthetically, that can be short-range teleportation. Disengage and then move means you moved in a way that did not allow them to attack you. So, bloop,
yeah, I mean,
short teleport.
It will help if you're able to break things down. Like, if you can kind of extract the flavor from the D&D book and be like, mechanically, what's happening? Like you said with disengage. All disengage means is you escape from a combat situation without taking harm, right? You're not harmed in the movement away. So if you want that to be short-range teleportation, that's fine. I mean, the mechanics are right there. If you want that to be like, I turn into water and I just sort of puddle away, you can do that. You know, it's when you use that kind of ability for something that is, I don't know, a little bit outside, maybe a little too, you know, short-range teleportation as far as disengage goes is one thing. Teleportation, be like, I can just at-will teleport a mile away. It's like, I don't know if you can.
No longer. Or if, like, the aesthetics of your disengage looks like, oh, I turn into that puddle and water away. Also, whenever I touch fire, it gets extinguished because I'm made out of water. It's like, not anymore.
No, this is people water. Because it doesn't do that to fire. It just hurts you.
Yes. So it's like, you have to know where the lines are in regards to using the game rules, but, like, the easiest way to get comfortable with homebrewing is, as Ben said, breaking it down to the, like, fine pieces, the simplistics of each ability, and find out what it does, and then see what other ways that can, look, like, what other things you can make that
and
look
I,
like.
I think, too, when I want to go back to magic items. Actually, I want to make 2 points. One I want to say quickly because I'm going to forget it. If you're making monsters or something, it benefits you to make a mock-up combat scenario with that monster just to figure out, like, what it looks like in action. So certainly it benefits you to no end if you have your player's character sheets there so you can actually determine what they can do, how easy it is for them to kill or be killed by this thing. But, you know, sometimes there's a level of secrecy, so there's a little less, you know, kind of inside knowledge, inside baseball on what your players can do, so the DM can't just, I don't know, screw them up by knowing exactly what's at their disposal. But even if you just said, like, I'm just going to put in, like, some relatively comparable figures, if only so you know, like, could they survive more than 2 hits from this thing? How frequently does it hit? How hard does this breath weapon on average do? Things like that. Just give it like a mock trial, a couple of test runs in a couple of settings maybe, just to figure out what it's capable of. And be aware that there's some abilities that just kind of put things in a different tier. Flight is one of those that just like takes something that's not a big deal and makes it an enormous problem. Invisibility is very often this way. If it sounds really strong, it probably is. I mean, higher level players won't have as much of a problem, but if they can't fly, they can't fly. You know, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And the other thing I want to say is about magic items, and that's I really enjoy making magic items. I think it's really fun. And I I found that if you want to give... So a magic item seems like maybe a difficult thing to manage because it's very often just a boon for the players. It's just better to have it, right? Like a sword that's plus one. It's like, why would you not use it? You know, that thing that shoots lightning, that cylinder that shoots lightning we were talking about, like, why would you not use it? You know, it's just this thing that at any given moment, they're just better. And the way that I got around that when I made a bunch of magic items was I didn't. So either the effect was very small and limited, in which case it was useful, but not hugely so. But more often what I did was I gave it was more like a cursed item almost, insofar as it had a negative effect that went along with its positive effect. So you would get a benefit from using it, but you would be dealing with side effects. It's like taking a medicine. You know, it's like, well, the painkillers do help. Just don't take too many or your liver is going to fail. It's kind of like that. You know, nothing comes without consequence. And so I tried to match up the positive and negative to be relatively on the same scale. So I remember like one I gave was called the barter belt. And it was really simple. It was a belt that was very charming. It was like a sentient belt that could talk, and it would get you better prices with shopkeepers. It was kind of enchanted. But sometimes, if you didn't like roll well, because there was a roll mechanic, it would get you worse prices on things, and it would like commit to those prices for you. So you always ran this risk of kind of getting screwed out of your money. And I remember there was one I had... the one I gave you, the Lifocals. It was...
Lifocals were dope. And that was a good pun, you. Too.
The Lifocals were a pair of glasses that could see enchantments, hidden effects, you know, like fairies can sort of disguise themselves and stuff like that. They could see through that sometimes. The more you use them, the more likely it was that it would... show you things that weren't really there. So you had to be a little careful how often you use them, because you might be getting false information and you might end up hurting yourself or somebody else or just being led down the wrong path and so on and so forth. You know, there was one that gave you a lot of charisma, but it did it at the cost of making you have to sleep for longer comparative to how long you wore them, right? That was the penny loafers of heavy loafing.
The penny loafers of heavy loafing.
So that was that. It would it would boost your charisma by a pretty substantial margin. But if you wore them, the longer you wore them, the longer you had to sleep. And like unwakeable, you would be sleeping. So it was like, oh, you have to sleep for like whatever it is, 6 hours, 7 hours, something like that. You would like have to sleep for 10. Or eventually you'd have to sleep for like 20 straight hours. You know, so... positives and negatives will really, really help you balance out stuff that you create and not just be like, well, I want it to be a really good sword, so I guess it's on fire, and now I don't know what to do because all my players can just ignite everything without really having to try. It's like, yeah, but give it a bad effect, and they'll be more hesitant to use it than they would otherwise be if it was just a better thing.
My favorite, in the same regard, tool for making, you know, homebrew magical items that you don't want to break the game, that you don't want to be these like super OP whatever's, I give people bullshit all the time. Bullshit's great. Like I make these dumb magical items that have no connection to in-game mechanics in regards to what they do. So it's like, and I'm pretty sure, I know for a fact I stole this example. I'm not quite sure where I stole it from. But it's like a bag of marbles, and the marbles always roll uphill instead of downhill.
That might be like, Numenera.
That's Numenera, a dumb item. Yeah. I might have stolen it's that from Numenera.
It's a good
item.
It's like just weird.
That's the thing, is like, it's weird. It doesn't, like, it's not like, oh, this is a plus one sword that's going to help me in combat. But I know if I put that in the hands of one of my players, they're going to come up with some crazy, ridiculous bullshit to use it to their advantage, and all of a sudden, now, instead of giving them, like, a magical item that helps them, and that's kind of boring or standard, I've given them, like, some ridiculous magical item that I know for a fact is not overpowered, because these marbles just roll uphill and that's it, but, like, they've used it in a cool way, and they've found it to be, like, this huge boon based on their own actions and their own decisions. So, like, taking... Actually, Numenera, the oddities from Numenera is a great section of that book in regards to finding, like, weird bullshit magical items. But, like, something like that, and just giving them these, like, even if you don't tell them what it does or what it's for, and, like, it's just, like, a mysterious trinket, and, like, they have to figure that shit out for themselves, is great, because all of a sudden they got this mystery... And they think it has these huge implications, and they're going to put so much time and effort into it. And it's like, oh, if you hit this butt on the bottom, a little tin man comes out, and he pretends to be chopping wood for 2 minutes. And, like, you're just like, that's it? And he's like, yeah, that's it. Yeah. You figured out my puzzle. Congratulations.
The prize is yours.
It's a good fun... And, like, I know we talk about being on the same team, and it's, you know, everyone's together in this, and it's supposed to be fun... But sometimes you just need to punish the player.
But I think
you
too,
you just need to get throw them on a goose chase. But also, to get
that stuff is part of world building too, where especially in like a magic world where there's people who just like think about like we live in a world that's got a lot of amazing things in it that are like highly functional, super advanced magnet trains, spaceships, stuff like that, right? Super functional, highly useful. Very advanced, took a lot of intelligence. And then you have people who just make, like, wooden catapults out of toothpicks. Like, still inventive, but functionally useless. You know? Still cool stuff. So you have to imagine, in a magic world, there's people who have a reasonable quantity of magic, and they're like, I'm just gonna make this, like, stupid thing. And, like, people find them, you know? I mean, it is like the oddities in Numenera, where it's just like, I know there's one that's just like, this box just projects a fish that swims in circles. And I'm like, I love that thing because it's so stupid, but it's so interesting. And I think that that's the kind of stuff that I agree with you about, like the bag of marbles. Like, it doesn't seem like it's useful, but it's not actually your job necessarily to determine what is or is not useful, and to specifically give your players things that are or are not useful. It's just really your job to fill out the treasure chest and be like, this is what you found, take it or leave it. It's of as much consequence as you make it. You know, people will find a use for marbles that roll uphill. I remember there's a magic item in 3.5 that I bought because I just thought it was really kind of funny, and it was like a bead that would absorb like 10 gallons of water. Like, that was the only thing it did. It would absorb 10 gallons of water, and it would, like, emit 10 gallons of water. That's the only effect it had, and it was, like, stupid expensive, and I was like, I want it. And we were in a situation where we'd killed a guard by dragging him into the water, and we needed to convince somebody that we were, like, on their team, but we were like, oh, we'll get in the guard's outfit, and somebody's like, but it's wet, and I was like, I have a bead! I have a bead! And the plan went off because I had this, like, asinine, like, stupid, pointless magic item that does, like, almost nothing of real use. But in this circumstance, I was like, oh my god, I have the perfect thing for this. You never know. And so a lot of times those kind of, like, quote-unquote useless trinkets are kind of more fun to have. They have more... They don't necessarily have more story behind them, but they force the players to be more creative. And I think that when you have to make something work, you get a little more attached to it. You know, you're like, no, these are my marbles. Like, I remember using, like, I like these marbles. They saved me, you know? And so consider that with your homebrew stuff too. Things that seem kind of inconsequential, but have a very specific, possibly simple effect. So it doesn't have to be, like I said, this big positive, big negative. It doesn't have to be just, like, very strong sword number 2. it can be just bag of marbles that rolls uphill. You know, the immovable rod is one of, like, the most classic and useful items in the entire game, and all it is a stick with a button that once you press the button, never moves again. That's it. And it's, like, the best thing in the whole game.
Oh my god, the amount of times a former GM of mine would take my immovable rods away from me, because I would always play, like, skill jock rogues, and we would be, like, level 10 starting, so we'd have, like, a shitload of gold, and it's just like, buy whatever magic stuff you want, and I would be like, I just want, like, 8 immovable rods. And all of a sudden, I was, like, this unstoppable, you know, I could, like, climb everything, I could technically fly, because I could just, like, monkey bar in midair these immovable rods and stuff. And so, like, no problem ever was something I couldn't solve. And so, like, he started making me, like, oh, roll a dexterity check. Oh, you dropped it, and it landed with the button in a crack, and it clicked it, so you can't reach the button because it's down a crack, and so, it won't move.
So be forewarned. And I was sometimes, like, these inconsequential things are game-breaking. But it's still fun, you know? The other thing So I don't want to get into this too much. This isn't what I was going to say, but I want to say it anyway. You know, we have an episode on world building. Again, that is a form of homebrew that has a more narrative thing. But again, in the same way, feel free to look into the D&D books or any medium that or media that you like and use that as the scaffold. Say, like, I really want to do a story that involves, like, well, I don't know, like, I want to do a treasure hunt story. Like, go watch Treasure Planet. Go read Treasure Island. Go, or Muppet Treasure Island. What's your preference? It's a good movie. Or Fool's Gold. You know, you want to run, like, a monster hunt? Go get Ghostbusters. You know, I mean, like, you can use these things. They're at your disposal, and there's no reason to say, like, oh, where does this start? What's the middle point? And what's the end? Strip all the things out of it except, like, the bare, like, characters go to this place because of thing that happened in beginning. Just use that. And then start laying over your own stuff. So I don't want to get too much into that, but that's part of it too. It's the same with all of that narrative stuff, gods, politics, wars, history, religions, that kind of thing. But the other thing that you will almost inevitably encounter as a DM, I have had it happen, I think, every single time I've run a game, and I've certainly had it happen most times I've played it. Is when you have a player who wants to have a homebrewed class. Races aren't too bad, because those are kind of like very... There's not like a huge amount of benefit most of the time. Like, it's like dark vision or no, +2 strength or +2 charisma. You know, you can kind of like move those things around without too much difficulty, but a homebrewed class has like probably the most room for error and for things to get like way out of control. Can get classes that are out of control just from the base stuff. I mean, if you're good at like multi-classing, I mean, you can be basically unstoppable by level 15. But homebrew classes have, in my experience, this reputation of being like really not built for equalized play so much as like this really rad aesthetic that either results in a character who is ludicrously absurdly powerful or functionally useless, you know, like, and sometimes I've been on a, you know, D&D wiki and stuff has like a huge homebrew listing, and some of them are really cool sounding, and you read it and you're like, what do I do with this? I mean, this, I can't even think of a scenario I would use this if it wasn't specific and only me playing. Or sometimes you read it and you're like, oh, by level 3 I have like an explosive radius that's like a nuclear bomb that doesn't affect me. Like, all right, that's probably not gonna fly. But you'll probably encounter it. So, I mean, Scott, when you get somebody who's like, oh, I got this homebrew class, let's not even say like built myself. Let's just say like found somewhere. What's your, like, how do you handle it?
Well, here's the thing. If they had said built myself, it would very much depend on the person and if I knew they were capable of doing it or not. I know plenty of people that would be able to manage it. I know more, though, I know people that I would trust to balance it. And then I know people who would just, like, ignore the fact that it needs to be balanced.
Yeah, absolutely.
But if they were, like, pulling something offline that was a homebrew class, I would take a look at it. The first thing I always look at with that is how complete it is. If it looks like a page out of a player's handbook, then I'll take a closer look. But if it's just, like, a quick spreadsheet with, like, weird lines and, like, obviously just the character from, like, One Punch Man or something like that, it's like, no, you can't use this because this was... No one put in the time and effort to playtest this, and I'm not about to put the time and effort into playtesting something.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point.
Really,
I mean, you have
it.
To be a little more sort of discriminating, probably, when it comes to this thing, because I, like I said earlier, there's kind of levels of consequence, and I imagine this is the most consequential in some way, because not only is it really difficult to gauge something you've never seen before in terms of effectiveness. At some point, if you let it ride out, that's the character that's been there's a cat. There's a distraction cat.
Yeah, my cat.
Broken. Anyway, so
my cat
there's they've been playing the character for, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 6 levels, you know, and it's like all of a sudden be like, oh, it's too strong now. Roll somebody else. They're gonna be like, this is my character, though. Like, I put all this time in. I mean, I've leveled them up. I've been playing the whole game as this with the intention of getting to, I don't know, level whatever. And they're going to be really hesitant, probably, to just kind of take that smiling. So, like you said, the level of completeness really does matter, because sometimes a game can just go on and on and on. You didn't necessarily expect it to, but it does, and you want to know that it looks pretty good from A to Z. And what pretty good means, hard to know. Again, I mean, this could be one of those times that you're just going to have to maybe say, like,
I don't know,
stack it against something that's relatively similar. Like, well, it, you know, if it's like a, like, I don't know, like in the steampunk thing, like a marksman who has like guns and stuff, you know, if it's like, well, what does, like, the sorcerer look like at this level? Like, what kind of damage output are we talking? Like, what kind of loadout are we talking? How many abilities are we talking? And if it looks kind of in the same ballpark, you know, you're probably okay. The game's built for it. If it's, like, way different, it may still be okay, but this is another time where it may be worth it for you to, like, roll that character up for yourself and just put it in a scenario and figure out, like, what that actually looks like in motion. Because sometimes small things matter a huge amount, but they don't look obvious when you're just looking at a spreadsheet or something.
Yes. And I think the big deal with it is, like, if you were ever faced with that, and the person's like, oh, no, I really want to play this thing that has not yet been made by Wizards of the Coast, right? But this homebrew person made it. First off, double check, Unearthed Arcana, all of the supplement books and all that stuff.
In some form, anyway.
It may already exist in some form. And then, instead of using that homebrew one that you can't trust, spend the time you and your players sit down and make your own homebrew. I would do that before trusting an online homebrew, really. Because, like, here's the thing, if, like, 9 times out of 10, when a player has some, like, ridiculous, crazy homebrew class, it's because they want to do thing X, Y, or Z, and, like, this was the class that allowed them to do it. But if you're just like, oh, if you just want to be able to do this, we can build you that out of a fighter. And, like, you don't even have to be a weird class. You can just be a SRD fighter and still do this thing. So I think it's important to communicate with your players in this regard and be like, hey, man, like, what do you really want to do? And sometimes the answer to that question is a little rough, and you have to, it's a little impossible. I remember one answer I got was like, I want to be able to throw two throwing axes, one in each hand, pull out two more, throw those, and then pull out two more and attack. And I was still a pretty new DM at this time, but like the bottom line was the player wanted to be able to attack six times a turn. And he didn't see it as that. He saw it as, you know, throwing hatchets and then attacking. But basically, like, what it boils down to was he wanted to be a monk. He just didn't realize he wanted to be a monk.
He
because monks are people that get that many attacks. So, like, exactly, which you can do because all monk weapons can be done with flurry of blows, so you can do it with the darts or the throwing knives or whatever monk weapon.
It is kind of strange. I mean, for all the variety that comes with homebrewing, you know, the game doesn't really have that many mechanics, you know? Like, it's like, you can attack, and how many times around can you do that? How much health do you have? How fast can you move? You know, how many spells can you cast, which essentially just comes down to how hard can you hit in one round, and at what range can you do it? And there's actually quite a lot of variety that you can come up with from that, but it does reduce down to a lot of similar points. And I, you know, we're not saying like, oh, they just have to be a monk because that's what the monk can do, so now they're a monk. But again, you can say like, oh, do you want to just be a monk and I'll let you use this weapon instead? And they might say like, oh, yeah, that's way easier. You know, and if they're hellbent on having something else, again, I mean, that's where reskinning kind of comes in. I find that homebrew that starts on that strong basis of like, kind of what's in the game already, and then, you know, changes 10-20% feels pretty good. There's not a lot of like stuff that goes on that just goes like, oh my God, this is a wreck. But stuff that's coming from like you said, like, I want to be One Punch Man. It's like, well, that is so outside the realm of what this, I mean, that essentially what you want to do is kill anything you punch the first time, which it's hardly even a game at that point. I mean, that show is not even about like, can he win? That show is about existential crisis. So like, you know, you have to kind of keep that stuff in context too. That some things like look very functional and wouldn't fit anywhere else in the game, so they would have to be homebrewed, but that doesn't necessarily mean they fit. And you know, you do have the right to veto any homebrew material that really doesn't work for you, because always, you'll know what kind of game you're running. If it's very adventure centric, you know, you can have combat classes, but maybe they're not as useful, and it's worth letting the players know that. So if they want to do this like really elaborate combat thing, it's like, well, you can just know that you may not really be using that to its fullest potential. The same with exploration, the same with social stuff, you know.
Well, I mean, here's the thing is, I think in that regard, that comes down to a role-playing question, because you look at like, I know you don't listen to it, but Critical Role is a podcast which I listen to. It's a live play Dungeons & Dragons podcast, and like, they're barbarian, right? He has a -2 modifier to intelligence. So, and he is a barbarian. Mm-hmm. Strictly combat class. That's it, right? He participates in all of the narrative. You never forget he's there, because he is role-playing a character who is involved. Regardless of his how helpful his input is, he's still involved. And sometimes he's able to, like, dumb insight.
He thinks in straight lines.
Situations through, but most of the time he's just like, yeah. So, like, I think that that's an important thing to take in consideration. Also, I think that if you're ever thinking about homebrewing or modifying or doing anything to a character class, go to Unearth Arcana and look at what they did to the Ranger. I think that that is the prime example, because they made three iterations of the Ranger. There was the original one in the book. There was the second one made by... I think it was Chris Perkins,
he made
the Magicless Ranger, which I think is super dope. I'm a huge fan of. And he really walks you how to homebrew a class step by step in that article. He tells you how he did it ability by ability. And then they did the alternate Ranger, where they fixed a lot of, like, honestly, the Ranger's uselessness. It's the kind of thing where... Read those articles. They'll give you a really good insight if you ever need to, you know, kind of homebrew a class.
I think I'm fairly tapped.
I don't know, man.
There's always more to say, but I mean, I think this is at least a good start. I think just say, you know, if you're feeling hesitant, like, that's okay. Like, it is a little nerve-wracking to just change things. But really don't be afraid to copycat stuff. You know, if you take it down to its bare pieces and then build it up from there,
always,
you'd be surprised how hard it is to notice.
Well, that's how you learn a skill, is you imitate the skill or someone who has the skill, and then you imitate it enough times and then you have it. So go ahead and copy for your first couple tries, and then... Move on from there and give it, you know, a shot solo. And if you have any more questions about homebrew, or if you want any specifics
I'll tell you
about
all about
homebrews
Magic
Ben and I have done, you can go ahead and... Oh, Magic Walmart, it's a great homebrew. You can email us at dungeoncasterspodcast@gmail.com.
At dungeon_casters. I go on there occasionally, and I... mostly just look at, like, Scott's girlfriend's tweets, because he's got her locked on the top of our account.
I don't know how I did that, but it's okay, because I love her.
Oh, we're also on iTunes. We forgot to mention that in the last couple episodes. Probably a lot of you know that.
You can see
on our feed that, like, we get a lot of, like, of listens through, like, Apple Core Media stuff. So probably a lot of you know that, but it's worth saying again, if you want to find us on iTunes and download the episodes onto your Apple device, you just have to look up Dungeon Casters under the podcast tab. I think that's all of our spiel about where you can find us and how trendy we are.
Well, while you're there, you can always give us a 5-star review and a rating. 5-star reviews are always good, right?
Yeah. I think so.
Okay, so I think that's the end of the episode, right?
Yeah, that felt like such a setup.
Ben.
It was painful. Yeah. Yes, Scott. Yes.
Hey, Ben.
Yes.
Hey, Ben.
I'm here.
Hey, Ben. What happens when a ghost drinks moonshine?
There's such specific terms that, like, the play on words is so present, and I'm getting...
He gets sheep face. In this podcast, we used Achilles and News Sting by Kevin MacLeod of Accompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons.